In today's episode, what does it feel like to take on the EU and lose? And The Guardian's political correspondent in Washington, Lauren Gambino, on why it was a good night for democratic women in the US. We'll start after this. The clock is ticking down on Brexit. Britain is leaving the EU on March the 29th, ready or not. To hit that deadline, the Prime Minister has to get an agreement now.
The only way of dealing with that is by trying to do the best you can every second, every minute that passes.
It must be a lonely task when a nation's future depends on you.
And of course, in the end, it boils down to the kind of support you have, and in particular, your own government and your own people.
3 years ago, Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis was in the room, leading negotiations with the EU to save Greece from economic collapse. His refusal to cave in to enforced austerity won him the backing of the Greek people.
Earlier, thousands of people celebrated in Athens' central square. It could send Greece on an exit path.
But in the end, his country was unable to resist the will of the EU. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does it feel like to take on the EU and lose? Yanis, thanks for joining us. You're Theresa May. Mm-hmm. How do you feel? Can you imagine being Theresa May?
Well, this is a very tough call. Apprehension, of course. And if she has any concept of the European Union, which by now I hope she does, she should beware the ultimatum, because this is what the EU does. 11th hour ultimatum.
What's going to happen at the 11th hour for Theresa May?
Well, I think that she's going to face a take-it-or-leave-it offer. It's already been written in Brussels. We don't know what it is. They will always try to sugarcoat it. And if you are prepared to fudge it with them, they will participate in the fudge, which means that they will couch it in a language that you can then pretend to be able to sell to your own people. The European Union is very good at fudging. It is the world capital of the fudge.
Well, Belgium actually is, isn't it?
indeed. But somewhere in there will be a hidden or not so hidden ultimatum.
Do you think she already understands that now?
Well, judging by her demeanour over the last year, she doesn't seem to have understood much of what is pertinent about the European Union. The very acceptance of the process that Brussels has imposed upon her.
This first session was useful, indeed, to start off on the right foot.
Remember when Mr. Barnier came out with his announcement of how the negotiations are going to be structured? He said there will be two phases. Phase one, you give us everything we want. Phase two, we discuss what you might
and
want.
We agreed in the first step, we will deal with the most pressing issues, the single financial settlement.
At that point, she should have realized that that was a declaration of war. This is not how you conduct negotiations. If I come to you into your house and say, OK, you give me your house, and then I'll discuss with you whatever it is that you want to discuss. The answer is, well, no. There's no way that she would ever get anything decent out of those negotiations.
So you're arguing that it was a mistake for Theresa May to agree to negotiate the withdrawal first, and including in that the divorce bill, before moving on to talk about the future relationship.
The point I'm making is that you can never have a negotiation which leads to a mutually beneficial outcome if you have two phases, and the first phase involves you giving everything to the other side, hoping that after you've given everything away, you'll get something in return when there's absolutely no commitment in the second phase. No negotiations can ever lead to an honourable agreement if they are structured along those lines.
It feels as though the Prime Minister may be on the brink of a breakthrough on the Irish backstop and the withdrawal agreement. Only then will she be invited to a Brussels summit on the critical second part of negotiations, agreeing an outline on the future trading relationship. So what will she experience?
In terms of the physical experience, she's going to arrive and there would be millions of reporters. And there will be some scripted lines that she's going to have to utter to them.
I'm here with a very clear message. The UK is leaving the EU, but we will continue to play a full role until we leave, and we'll be a strong and dependable partner after we've left.
that maybe she's not comfortable with because they were scripted for her.
We continue to work closely together.
And then she would be walking in there, and then there will be all the niceties, in cricketing terms, sledging. And then there will be the surprises. She will have some expectations as to what the different leaders are going to say. Mr. Juncker will say, Mr. Barnier will say. I have no doubt that there will be surprises.
Okay, so we're in this place. You've walked in, you've passed the journalists trying to grab you. Anything you remember about what it looks like, where the room is, who's in that room?
I can tell you that the sandwiches are really terrible. I can tell you that the coffee is even worse than in American hotels. I don't think I've had worse coffee in my life. And the rooms themselves were designed to torture whoever is in there. And I'm not just talking about Theresa May, I'm talking about Barnier and all the others. I don't know. I really don't understand how these people can suffer those rooms for so long. They are neon lit. You feel like a battery chicken in there. You have these tables that form a very large rectangle. And you have screens in front of you because you can't see everybody in the room because the table is so large. And you've got minders sitting behind you, whispering things into your ear. And it's mind-bogglingly soul-destroying. But of course, if your nation's and your people's future depends on this, you're extremely focused.
Are there windows?
There are no windows.
No windows?
No. I was in one of those rooms for 11 hours once, and I was the focal point. I was being attacked by everyone. I spent 11 hours in there, effectively deflecting all the pressure that was being put upon me. And I can tell you that when I walked out, even though I'm reasonably fit, I was dizzy, disoriented, and I didn't know what time of the day was. It could have been 10 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 8 in the evening. I had no concept of what the time was, and I realized that it was 2 in the morning. When I stepped out and walked into the night in Brussels, it was raining, and Brussels rain felt fantastic at that point because it allowed me to just, you know, put an end to this 11-hour neon-lit existence.
And during those 11 hours when everyone's shouting at you, you must have felt...
Well, no, they don't even shout. I wish they were shouting. I mean, I'm a Mediterranean. I do shouting. I know how to handle that. No, it's the drudgery of it all. It's that it's all very civilized. There was never any personal attack or even criticism. What there is this constant recapitulation of things that have absolutely nothing to do with our common interest. And I would give what I consider to be a concise argument that deserved an answer. Tell me why I'm wrong. And then it was as if I had sung the Swedish national anthem instead of presenting my argument. And that can be soul-destroying.
So earlier you mentioned Theresa May's demeanour. What is it about her demeanour that tells you she might not be in a good place for these final Brexit talks?
Well, she seemed to be surprised by Salzburg. It was inevitable that there was a setup.
It's been a really humiliating week for Theresa May. She woke up this morning to gruesome headlines in the newspapers after a terrible summit in Salzburg, Austria, where
she was invited to go in there and talk to them about checkers, and they would rubbish it. They've done it before. Remember that famous dinner in 10 Downing Street?
The report in a German newspaper claimed that Theresa May begged Jean-Claude Juncker for help.
She was very surprised that tweets came out leaking how silly she was or how inexperienced her team was. This is what the EU does.
Is that the sort of thing that happened to you? You had a private conversation and then... bam, it was all over the
newspapers. It was worse than that, because I wouldn't have minded at all. I'm a strong believer in transparency. If my conversations with anyone were live-streamed, I would have been happy. What I was not happy with was that I was having meetings with these people that were very sensible and were mutually respectful. And then all this information came out, which was completely distorted and fake, about what I said, what they said to me, things that were never said either by me or the other side. And that was done intentionally to create a lot of noise and to demean me in public while being sensible and respectful towards me in private.
Varoufakis apparently attended a different meeting than all the other finance ministers. I say that, Tom, because Varoufakis is saying that things went well, that they're making progress, and everything else we have heard about that meeting, both publicly and privately, that Varoufakis took, quote, a hammering.
That is a standard ploy.
The character assassination.
Well, in my case, it was. In the case of Theresa May, no, is something more subtle than that. It is an attempt to diminish her gradually in the eyes of her own public and her own party and her own cabinet. I think it is very important to understand that the EU is not a government, and therefore it does not negotiate like a government. There's no democratic mandate for the technocracy that you're facing. I think this is crucial. When you look at the face of Mr. Barnier, of Mr. Juncker, whoever it is that you're meeting in Brussels, you've got to realize that these are very insecure people. And they're very insecure because they don't have a mandate. What they have is a monster of a technocracy. A technocracy that has evolved over decades on the basis of a kind of cartel-like get-together, collusion, coordination. And all cartels feel very coy and insecure about whether they will continue to collude or whether one of them is going to try to pull the rug from under his competitors who are now colluding with him. So imagine now a whole apparatus of the European Union based on these cartels of the car industry, the banking industry sector, which is gigantic, the food sector, common agricultural policy, all those things. They have to manage this without a democratic mandate. On the one hand, they feel responsible. In a sense, they feel self-righteous that they are responsible for this beast that has been created over decades. But at the very same time, they have their own vested interests because they are running a big organization. And here comes Theresa May. If you give her too much, then you are undermining the cohesion of that gigantic organization. In my case, and I think that's probably something that Theresa May will one day admit to, the real war was not happening in Brussels. It was not happening in those awful neon-lit rooms with Juncker and the rest. The real battle is always at the home front, in your own cabinet in 10 Downing Street in the House of Commons.
Just on Friday, the Prime Minister secured a hard-won agreement from her cabinet. Today, during a stormy session in Parliament, Theresa May was repeatedly interrupted.
Turning to Brexit, Mr. Speaker, I want to pay tribute to my right honourable friends, the members.
Battle was lost at home. It was not lost in Brussels. When I was in Brussels, I felt completely in control of what I was doing because I knew what they would do. I had a plan. But when your own government doesn't have your back, that is the most distressing feeling. And there's nothing you can do to prepare for that when your own comrades stab you in the back.
The talk of rebellions and some pretty strong language about the fate awaiting Theresa May. She battled on through yet another crunch session in the Commons.
Or signal to your interlocutors in Brussels or in Frankfurt and Berlin, don't listen to him because we will have a deal with you once you get rid of him. Is there anyone who has any doubt that the Tory party has already dismissed Theresa May from their collective mind or individual mind, but their only problem is they have not agreed amongst themselves on who is going to replace her.
So you're basically arguing that whatever happens, even if Theresa May calls this a win, the EU will have got its way. How did you feel at the end of it all?
There is a lightheadedness that I felt. It was as if I was a witness to somebody else's body moving around the room. But it all depended on how I felt vis-a-vis my colleagues in the Greek government. There were occasions when I would have a terrible meeting, an energy-sapping, mind-destroying meeting in Brussels. Then I would go to my hotel and feel I did the right thing, and my colleagues and my prime minister are with me, and the people on the streets are with me. I would feel great, even though I was dead. But when I felt that our own home front was buckling under, it felt like a very painful kind of death.
Yanis, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Brexit is reaching a crunch point. Follow all our coverage in Brussels and Westminster at theguardian.com. After the break, who are the real winners of the US midterms? Welcome back. Now, US political correspondent for The Guardian, Lauren Gambino, reflects on a mixed night for Donald Trump.
I spent the evening at an election night party with a lot of Democrats. It's where Nancy Pelosi spoke to the crowd after she was certain that the Democrats would win the House.
My friends, tonight a historic victory is within our grasp. A victory
Nancy Pelosi is the House Democratic leader, and she's poised to be the Speaker of the House. I was watching all of the results come in with Democrats who, you know, started the night a little bit nervous because they had these flashbacks of 2 years ago when they were crowded in a glass-ceilinged room in New York City waiting for the first female president to emerge. And of course, we, you know, history unfolded far differently than that. But then as the night went on and the return started to come in, the mood became a lot happier, a lot more upbeat. People started to dance. So this was, you know, far, far different than we remember 2 years ago. Democrats won the House of Representatives. That's the biggest takeaway of the night. Democrats voted in extraordinary numbers for an off-cycle election season. And they sent, you know, the clearest message possible. They want a check on the president of the United States. Donald Trump did strengthen his hand in the Senate. Republicans won a few seats there, but with Democrats in the House, they can subpoena Donald Trump, they can go after his taxes, they can, you know, look into Russia, wherever they really want to go. Other top lines, women did extremely well. They broke all previous records. Next Congress, there will be more than 100 women serving, though we kind of pale in comparison to other countries around the world. This is a big deal for American women. And diversity, there were so many firsts last night. In Kansas, Charisse Davids was a first-time candidate who beat an incumbent.
You know, I always encourage people to please chant democracy. Democracy, democracy.
She is a lesbian Native American woman. She will be one of two Native American women in Congress next cycle, which is a record and also history-making. We've never had a Native American woman serve in the U.S. Congress before. In New York, we saw the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
We have elected the first campaign and the first member of Congress from this district to not accept any corporate lobby as funds.
She's been kind of known around the world as this progressive upstart, but she will make history as the youngest woman ever to serve in Congress at just 29 years old. We also have another history maker in Michigan.
I want them to know, you know, as I uplift the families of the 13th congressional district, I'll uplift them every single day being who I am as a proud Palestinian American and woman.
Yes!
Rashida Tlaib will be one of the first Muslim American women elected to Congress. She will serve alongside Ilhan Omar.
The first woman to wear a hijab.
Who is from Minnesota and is also a Muslim American woman. So just all across the country, from one side to the other, we saw a lot of historic firsts and women elected. I think what's important to note about this wave of women is that it was inspired by the Women's March.
We'll never be defeated. People united.
It was inspired by the activism in response to Trump. These are women who had not been politically engaged and were totally activated by Donald Trump's election. They were women who, you know, maybe voted but didn't do much more. And all across the country, these women have been mobilizing. And then suddenly we saw women running for office. But now when you have this many women serving together in the House and in the Senate, I think you'll see more bipartisanship. The few Republicans who would cross the aisle were always the female senators. I think for so long, women have pretty much believed that they had to have more credentials than their opponent. But after Donald Trump beat a woman who was extremely qualified for her office, then other women started to say, okay, fine, I'm far more qualified than I need to be. My life experience counts as qualifications. I can run. And I think as a reporter covering that, that's pretty inspiring to watch happen very organically and sort of in these large numbers. They will make a huge difference. And I think one day we'll look back at this moment as being one of those turning points, sea changes in American politics.
That's it for today. Go on, subscribe. I know you want to. My thanks to Yanis Varoufakis, Lauren Gambino and Max Sanderson. The producers are David Walters and Michael Lee Rao. Sound design is by Axel Cocoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow. Join us then.